Sir Andrew Horsburgh Porter, Reel 3. Sir Andrew, you mentioned that you thought that the training you got at Bovington was effective. Were there any particular instances you can think of that you thought, well, I'm glad I did that, I'm glad I learnt that at Bovington?
Well, of course. I don't quite understand. This is, if you start any sort of training, you want to go to the top. And they had Bovington and Lulworth where had produced the top training. And they've been scientifically worked out. And I tell you what, the first time I'd ever seen it was the use of cinematograph slides, magic lantern slides. It's so much easier to learn something when you see it illustrated. Of course, that's old hat now. I mean, I suppose the army is now trained in all sorts of television and God knows what. But that was the first time we'd had really good diagrams produced by a magic lantern. It was first class. They were very professional. It was all in good stead in the years to come, when we had to train people on our own hook.
You mentioned that the 12th Lancers had been well treated. You were well treated at Bovington. How does that compare with how the 3rd Armoured Car Company were training in Egypt? Was there the same sort of...
Oh, tremendous liaison, yes. I mean, they were, they put themselves absolutely out to train us. And I think their sergeants were all in our mess, and the two subalterns, Uniac and Pip Roberts, were in our mess, and I think they were very happy. There was a tremendous liaison those days. I mean, there wasn't any liaison between us and them, but we had tremendous liaison, another line with the RAF. There was a fellow called Batchy Atchley, who became famous afterwards, and he used to come and stay with us. He took up polo, which is an odd thing for Batchy to do, but he stayed with us to learn about polo. I mean, the liaison in foreign parts is... tremendous. We learned a lot about the air from Batchy Atchley.
What, did you used to go up in planes, did you? You used to go up in
not, not officially.
And what, in fact you did, but did he go out in armoured cars with you?
Oh yeah, oh rather, yeah. Well, he and his twin, the two twin brothers. Well, I think this is a long way away from mechanization, but and I think that poor Batchy's dead. But I tell you one quite amusing little histoire was that he was always a good sporting chap. He liked playing polo with us. And he used to fly about the place. And there had been a recent order that you, a low flying, the RAF had desperately strong on low flying. And Batchy had gone home with some little single-seater plane on leave. And he was the greatest stunt pilot there's ever been. And he flew under the bridge of Budapest. And, you know, gave the locals rather a treat. But unfortunately, there's some stuffy old air marshal staying in Budapest. And Batchy got into tremendous trouble over there. He was stopped going to the Air Staff College, I believe. This is a long time ago. Because, unfortunately, the fellow saw him flying under the bridge at Budapest. Well, when he came back to Egypt in a slight sort of disgrace for his escapade, He was dining with Ian Shepherds one night, and he said, again, I got into slight trouble, because, I said, how is this? And he said, well, I must explain that down in the Delta, there are a lot of duck shoots, and some of them belong to rich Greeks and Egyptians, and others, there's one very good one, belonged to the residency, and there was one that belonged to a sort of a group of people, service people. However, Babbage said he took off to fly down to Alexandria and back. And when he arrived back, his station commander was greeting him with a very grim face. And he said, you've been doing low flying. And Batty said, low flying? Oh, yes, I dive-bombed a Greeky shooting party. And the station commander said, well, I'd have you know that the Greeky shooting party was the High Commissioner and the Air Officer commanding. Now, Batty got another rocket. He was a very good man. And as you probably know, he was probably a leading figure in the Battle of Britain subsequently. He was a splendid chap. Well, so, of course, are these two tank corps chaps we're talking about, Pip Roberts and Uniacke.
Did you, when you went out on exercises, did you have air cooperation?
Yes, we did. Yes. Very sort of, very shaky in those days. Used to drop something. Used to drop a message. But there was no, half a minute. There may have been, from RHQ, there may have been some wireless contact. I can't remember because I was only in the squadron. And we had no wireless in squadrons. But, yes, they used to drop messages. What? But mind you, I was only a bloody subaltern then, and I can't remember how they ran it. Yeah.
But it would be a reconnaissance rail, was it? A
long-distance reconnaissance down the desert.
You mentioned this close cooperation between the RTC and the cavalry, 12th Lancers at the time. Where do you think this idea sprung from, then, of sort of antagonism between the tank corps and cavalry?
Well, we didn't hear about it. I think it was at home, more or less. And I wouldn't like to produce any theories, because it never sort of came my way. I think it may have been that there were a few diehard opponents of the cavalry with that writer chap, what's his name? Little Hart. I think he was the head of it. And not that I ever met him. And one or two more who may have thought that the cavalry were going to take over a sacred cow. And that I rather agree with them. It is rather annoying to have somebody else coming in to take over your private baby. I never saw it. Because mind you, senior officers may have seen it. And there may have been clashes with senior officers between senior officers of both sides. But it certainly, we never saw it. I never saw it. And I suppose, again, this is theory, that a new, most of the old senior officers of the tank corps had all been in regiments before. The tank corps was formed, after all, in 1915-16. And a great many cavalry officers joined it like Toby Lakin, Master of the Wexford Hound, and various people like that, for the war, the duration of the war. And then gradually, I suppose, they built up a section of young men who had never been in anything else. But I don't know when they started calling it the RTR, but the Royal Tank Corps. It may have been that some of the young men who had never been in any other regiment had a tremendous esprit de corps and pride in their own tank corps. I'll quote the late CIGS, who was a Wickhamist. I never met him. What was his name?
Carver.
Carver is much younger than me at Winchester. Brilliant brain and a great man. And I noticed when he was received in honour at Winchester the other day, he broke all tradition by speaking in English instead of Latin. I should think that would probably give a key, an indication to his character. But he didn't like old things. No, I never met Mike Carver. But I should think a lot of his, possibly his generation, may have fermented a little trouble. I don't know. No, I've had...
Did you come across the idea at all that you becoming mechanized were taking over the tank corps role, that there was a sort of conflict between what you...
No, I don't think it was, because the idea were you... But you see, don't forget that we were armored cars, reconnaissance, pure reconnaissance. And the idea of the tank... the first thing they had, they did have this experimental armored division on Salisbury Plain. They wanted reconnaissance. They wanted armored car regiments for that. No, I don't think there was no clash with us. Whether afterwards, I don't know. I wasn't in it when they started to mechanize all the rest of the cavalry regiments in, 36, was it? Hurriedly before the war. There may have been clashes then because they were taking the cavalry, the newly mechanized cavalry tank regiments may have been taking over a role which the tank generals... I'm not qualified to say over this. I'm not qualified to say.
When you return to Egypt, what sort of standard would you say your NCOs and people were? They were all ready to take over cars.
Yes. Yeah. It's a top standard. Top standard. And... desperately keen and very efficient. And of course the warrant officers and sergeants were the best you could ever find. Tremendous esprit de corps. There's always been a tremendous esprit de corps, which was founded by years ago by Colonel Blaxton Houston afterwards. General Jackson Harrison. And he knew all about how to train, get the best out of officers and men, and make it an enjoyable... soldiering was an enjoyable pursuit by all ranks, thanks to the organization and thought which General Houston produced. And I may say here that... his line, he told me years afterwards when I was commanding, that the way to run a regiment and to get the maximum out of it was, first of all, It's a funny order. It's a funny order. A lot of people think it's a funny order. He said, first of all, you want to concentrate on the sergeant's mess, both in the quality of promotion and the quality of the comfort in the sergeant's mess. Next, the quality of the cookhouse and the quality of looking after your soldiers in the field, in barracks and in the field, and that is of supreme importance. And then finally he said, well, the officer's mess, you want to run a fairly good officer's mess. But there was that line. A lot of people would say, first of all, the men's mess, then the sergeant's mess, then the officer's mess. Mike was always said, first the sergeant's mess, and the quality of people in it, then the men's mess, which means that in times of discomfort or difficulty, you would always have hot food for them, either in peacetime or war. And then, well, the officers certainly see that they have a high standard in the officer's mess. And I think that was, it stuck me, stuck by me all my life. Those are the priorities.
And that was certainly the case in this period in the 30s, was it?
It was the period, always. Always. Before and after. Well, I don't know. Well, I don't know today, but I mean, certainly was during my lifetime.
When you got back, had the squadron you went into, had it got its armoured cars?
Oh, damn if I remember. I expect so. I expect so. I simply can't remember. No, memory is a bit. Well, I suppose so. I mean, we certainly started training.
How you organised when you got these cars at Rolls Royce?
Oh, yes, it wasn't a very good organisation. It was, to start with, they had two armoured cars as a squadron leader, squadron command. Don't forget, you see, you know, I think we're wasting a lot of time about this because it was before the wireless. The wireless was the lifeblood of everything. And we're talking about the time before we had wireless. And it was then organized in two cars for the squadron leader and second in command, and two sections of five cars each, with a subsection, with each section with two subsections. It was an unwieldy performance. Look, I suppose you had to do it with the flags, but it was an unwieldy command.
Because what? It slowed
down? Well, five cars were too much.
So how did the change occur when you had wireless?
Oh, Lord, yes. When we went to wireless, we had three troops of three cars, with a subaltern each. Yeah.
And just one car headquarters?
Two cars headquarters.
Two quarters.
I always had to have a forward and rear link. Always had to have a forward and rear link. But that period before we had wireless was it was experimental. We'd taken that over from the tank companies who were working on roads, I suppose.
So when you went into training, what kind of training things were you doing now that you'd shifted to from horses?
Well, they're doing the same thing. Reconnaissance, spreading out wide, taking a very wide view, covering as far as you could see, spreading out as far as possible, and producing a screen. But I think this is irrelevant to what happened when we changed to the wireless, you see. What we were doing in Egypt, we were training men to drive, operate. We did a lot of field firing, of course. We did a lot of field firing in the desert.
What do you mean by that?
Field firing, well, go out in the desert and put up targets, you see. No, there's no fear of anything except a camel coming along. And we did a tremendous lot of field firing exercises, firing on the move, and tactical exercises. Nothing better than the Western Desert for that. But I think that rather sort of finishes the training we did in Egypt. By the time we'd finished with Egypt, we reckoned that we could go anywhere with not a very useful armored car, and we could dig ourselves out of anything. And we knew a great deal about the use of high ground. High ground is the whole thing. You want to get to the high ground before the other chap.
But didn't you have a problem in the desert, and there's very little high ground?
Oh no, it's rolling, you know. Yeah. Oh yes.
Tell me, was your day different in now you've got armoured cars? The pattern of the day, did that change? I mean, for example, work in the morning and things in the afternoon?
Oh, I don't think so. No. No. No great difference.
What happened in the morning, for example, maintenance, was it?
Well, I mean, it depends on the time of year. In the hot weather, we'd be doing schools, driving and maintenance schools, everybody going through. Refresher courses, your individual training is you're polishing up every single man in the regiment right through the summer, in everything. And in the winter, with training, we mostly, sometimes I think we did a little bit of road training, because we knew that we'd probably have to go back to Europe, and we did a little bit of road training, setting up little schemes on the rather muddy little delta roads. But that is rather secondary importance to the wide-ranging, long-distance training which we did in the western desert, west of Mina, which we used to take 2 days operation. They used to go out on a Monday night and bivouac, which is all good training, and then operate from first light Tuesday morning all day and into the dark. I come back into Liga on the Tuesday night, and then come back to barracks on the Wednesday morning.
Who was responsible for setting up this sort of long distance ideas?
Oh, Colonel Hornby. This is the whole regiment going out. And then we had various other, Colonel Hornby was always going off, sending people off on various exploratory trips. He went down to Siwa. He went down to Siwa Oasis and Kufra and various places like that. Small expeditions. He sent us a small expedition up the most ghastly roads up the Nile Delta. I've forgotten, I didn't go on that one, but that was going up I think they went about 400 miles up the road, and they found actually some of those delta roads are worse than the desert, with mud and so on. And I think that was, as far as I can remember, that was a certain amount of a signal scheme, with the signals lorries, with a fairly good set, I think it was called a number 2 set, working signals back to Helmer.
Just to return to the regimental exercise there, what was the main point of taking the whole regiment out like that? What was the object of it?
Well, the object was... I didn't know, never asked. Just told, we went out. I think it was really to find out what we could do, what front you could cover. I never asked. I should think that was the idea. Well, didn't you know, in those days, We didn't ask questions. We thought of it, but we didn't sort of ask questions. We got on with the job and did what our senior officers told us, and they told us quite enough. See, this new-fashioned idea of telling every soldier what... I'm sure it's very good, but in those days, you obeyed orders. And unlike... I was attached to spendy chaps, the amateur soldiers, the yeomanry. I was attached to them for a short time training in the after years, and I discovered there's an old time saying that an order to an officer or soldier in a regular regiment is an order which is carried out. But in the yeomanry regiments, an order is a basis for future discussion. Yeah. So we didn't go and ask the colonel why he's trading the regiment out. We bloody well took the regiment out. But looking back on it, I think he wanted to see the whole regiment out and stretched. Is that an answer to your question?
But did you did you run into mechanical problems when you did that?
Oh Lord, yes, yeah, that was a very good thing to find out how. Well, I mean, we were probably the first people to discover that water is the most important thing in the desert. It's not for drinking; it's for keeping to put in the radiators. And those radiators to boil like hell, and you'd if you had enough water in the back of the car with these. We didn't have those German things then. We had, I've forgotten what sort of, how we carried the water. But you carried as much water as you bloody well could. And if you got to the top of a bit of high ground, if you're sensible, you cooled off for quite a long time before you did anything else.